I believe, I find, at times it's helpful for us just to state the basics as simply as possible. Just state the basics. We believe there was a man who died and came back to life. We believe there was somebody who lived. He was really alive. He died. And it wasn't a trick. It wasn't like, you know, a medical team dug into the earth and revived him or something like that. He was really dead and he came back to life as own power. That changes everything, doesn't it? Changes everything. And we believe that though that happened 2,000 years ago, that one is still alive. He's still alive. Now, we have information that tells us that that man is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He's the same yesterday, today, forever. So that means that who he is now is the same as what he was when he was alive the first time. And so if we want to know him, if we want to know this Christ who is still alive, then one of the best things we can possibly do is to open up the records of what he was like, how he lived when he was here on earth during the incarnation. That's what the book of Mark gives us. And so today's scripture reading comes from selected verses. We're not going to read the whole thing, but selected verses out of Mark chapter 1. I invite you to turn there with me if you have a Bible. Mark chapter 1. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. Skipping down to verse 21. And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, be silent and come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Verse 35. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And a leper came to him, imploring him, and kneeling said to him, if you will, you can make me clean. Moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I will be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them. But he went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in desolate places. And people were coming to him from every quarter. This is the word of the Lord. Normally, we think of being on the inside, having insider's knowledge, being an insider. Normally, we think of as desirable, right? That's the better lot compared with being an outsider. The insiders have all the access. They have the secrets, the insights. In fact, insider knowledge or insider trading has such an advantage that we have laws in place limiting what someone on the inside can do or say to try to make it a level playing field for everyone. All you have to do is think of Martha Stewart or any of the other numerous scandals to know that we can cheat using power and position that comes with being on the inside track. It's great to be on the inside. It's rough to be on the outside, normally. Can you think of any times, any ways, maybe serious, maybe silly, where being an insider or not has affected you one way or the other? My dad's side of the family has always had an extended family Christmas at my grandparents' house. Grandparents' house, everybody gets together for Christmas. For years, we would just use Grandma and Grandpa's regular glassware for our plates and cups. Problem was, as the family grew, there were more and more cups being put out, and everyone kept getting confused over whose cup was whose. And Grandma found that she had to keep washing all of these dishes over and over and over again. She got tired of it. So Grandma bought these reusable rubber cups, and she took a Sharpie and wrote everyone's names on it, on each one. Like aunts, uncles, cousins, everyone got their name written on a cup, and that was your cup. And you better not touch anyone else's. They only came out at Christmas when the whole family was there. Well, as the cousins got older, we started dating. Not each other. We started dating other people, bringing them in. I lived in Fulton County. I wasn't from Fulton County. Okay. We started dating, but the significant others didn't have a cup, right? They didn't have a cup. And so there were a couple options. Maybe we could get Grandma's regular glassware again, but Grandma was not about to put up with that. And she also said, there's no way I'm going to write your name on one of my precious reusable cups until I know you're here for keeps, right? Because who knows? You're here this year. Who knows whether you're going to be around next Christmas? And so Grandma settled on a solution where all of the boyfriends and girlfriends had these very distinct telltale red plastic cups. Disposable, discardable, clear as day. You don't belong here yet. And then when Danielle and I started dating, she was convinced she could break Grandma. That first Christmas, I'm going to get a real cup. But Grandma was a stickler for the rules. And Danielle got the disposable one like everybody else. Insider, outsider. And every family has those, don't they? Everybody has some sign that makes it clear as day whether you are in or not. It may not be a Christmas tradition, right? It may be whether or not you get to go on family vacation, who gets to go to the guy's hunting cabin, who gets an invitation to the new business plan. But whatever it is, every family has those things. Insider, outsider. It's actually part of human nature, as we're going to see a little later. It's part of human nature to do this. And the gospel writers deal with it. The gospel writers do not shy away from it. Mark deals with it. And he gives us a few surprises in Mark chapter 1. There is really something to that old business adage. It's not what you know, it's who you know. There is something to that. Do you have the knowledge or not? Are you an insider or an outsider, even when it comes to knowing God? And so Mark is going to show us, number one, he's going to show us the one that we need to know. He's going to show us, number two, the ones we think we'll get to know. The ones we normally think we'll get to know. And then he's going to show us, number three, the only way we can know. Even this early in the book, he's going to show us the only way we can know. Right? The one we need to know, the ones we normally think we'll get to, and then the only way we really can come to know. First, the one we need to. There was a time not all that long ago in our country where if you wanted to share the faith with somebody, you could simply start with feelings of guilt that you could know they had and then pointing them to Christ as the solution to that guilt. There was a time where that was true. There's been an accelerating change, particularly in the last 20 years, though it's hard for somebody of my age to know if that's really been the time frame at which this has taken place, or if that's just my own coming of age process of realizing that adults in the country don't think the same way that kids in Christianized South Central Pennsylvania do. But there's been accelerating change where if we lead in with, hey, Christ is the solution to your sin problem, people are going to dismiss what you say before you even get going. Because, in general, people out there do not believe they really need forgiveness. Because they do not believe they're really guilty of any great thing called sin. Because they do not believe there really is a God for them to be guilty before or need forgiveness from. That more and more is the prevailing mindset out there. And if you don't believe in God, then the gospel sure doesn't seem nearly as necessary. So our starting point in presenting the Christian story needs to go back further than sin and redemption. We got to go back further. And that's actually a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Because the Christian starting point does indeed go back further than sin and forgiveness. And that's exactly what Mark gives us. The Christian faith begins with, you look around and you see a material universe, and we are saying that outside of, beyond, behind and before that material universe, outside of what we see around us, there is a personal being, a God, capital G, who made it all. And because that's the case, that's why we see order and beauty in the world around us. He made mankind special. It's why we are so qualitative, absolutely qualitatively different than every other species of animals. And he made us to know him. That being made us to know him, and we blew it. We fell collectively from that knowledge, introduced all of this brokenness into the world. That's why the world works or doesn't work the way that we see. And Christianity teaches, in light of that picture of intended knowledge but separation from it, Christianity teaches that rather than letting us alone in that struggle, that personal being came down and entered this life and made himself one of us. What we just looked at throughout Christmas. God himself came down, made himself one of us. And that is exactly where Mark starts. Let me give you a couple of pieces here. In Mark chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, when verse 2 begins, as it is written, or just as it is written, the Greek word there that we translate for as, it always refers to what came before, not to what comes after. The quote from the Old Testament comes after, and it's a mixed quote anyways. It's from Isaiah and Exodus and Malachi, and so we sort of wonder, why does he just refer to Isaiah when it's a mixed quote? But the conjunction always refers to what came before. Mark is saying Jesus, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus, as Isaiah talked about. Isaiah, more than any other prophet, dealt with and predicted the future era, the day of salvation and renewal, characterized primarily by God's presence, God himself coming down and living among his people, restoring the earth in gladness and joy. And Mark is saying that the fulfillment of that promise in Isaiah, of God's presence filling the earth, the fulfillment of that promise has begun in the body, in the person of Jesus Christ. Verse 1, the name Jesus means Yahweh saves. Son of God was a term used to imply deity, a unique relationship with God the Father. And then let me give you two more pieces here. First, from verses 2 and 3, to show you that Mark is saying Jesus is the fullness of God's presence here on earth. In verse 2, he is quoting a Hebrew text, but the difference he puts in is the Hebrew text says, my way, referring to Yahweh, and Mark changes it to your way, referring to Jesus. He's subtly saying that Jesus is the embodiment of Yahweh himself. And then in verse 3, in the same way, he is quoting the Greek of Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, only instead of saying paths of God, Mark says his paths, referring to Jesus. Isaiah 40 had predicted a new exodus when Yahweh would return and triumphantly lead his people out of their Babylonian exile and to the land of promise. And Mark's saying that has now come to pass in the person of Jesus Christ. Yahweh's paths are really Christ's paths. From the very beginning of his book, Mark is telling us that the great God who made the universe, that we were all meant to know, and that we will have a hole in our hearts and in our lives until we do know, that God, that being, has made himself available, has made himself knowable in the person of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, in time and space and human history, the one we need to know. Now, we of course think in our natural selves that if we have lost that connection with God, not everyone has it, and a few people are going to get it back, we think that there are certain ones, certain types, who are most likely to be the ones to get that knowledge restored, the insider track to God. And there are ways that we naturally go about thinking about this. The ways that we naturally think about it automatically cause us to look down on other people that we think are not on that insider track, that we think are on the outside, that they are on, that they're marginalized, that they don't get that track, that knowledge to God. We think there are certain people who will get to, and the way we go about that automatically causes us to think there are some people who will not get to. And I'll prove it to you. Every time you apply for a job, what do you have to do? Every time you apply for a job, what do? You get out your resume, and that resume lists all of your experiences, all of your training, all of your skills, all of your work history, and you take that resume and you give it to the employer or the hiring committee or whoever it is, and you hope, your intent is, if my resume stands out, if my resume is better than everyone else's, or at least better than most of the other applicants, then that employer will look at me and say, come on in. It's yours. The job is yours. You've earned it. Right? Because of all of your worth and experience and proof, it is appropriate and fitting to give you this job. Justification. You are justified. We are justified in giving you this job. That word justification is an old religious word that doesn't get a whole lot of currency anymore. But we are all seeking to be justified in ways that we might never expect. To be on the inside communicates all kinds of things about power and position, acceptance and access. And it's not just professionally. It's also academically. You apply to a school, and what do? You assemble all your transcripts. You get your grades together. And if your grades are good enough, how do we even say it? If your grades are good enough, you get in. You get accepted. And we do it in informal, unofficial social ways too. If you're fit enough, if you're attractive enough, if your appearance is good enough, if you're beautiful enough, if you rise to the top financially, if you're cool. And what every single one of those systems is predicated upon is if you can make yourself stand out enough, then you will be brought in. And to make yourself stand out has to mean that there are other people who don't stand out, who don't get put in. The only way you can try to justify yourself is to make it mean that there will be other people you will look at and say, no, not you, because I'm higher than you are. There's some standard that I measure up to, and you do not. And Mark, completely throughout his gospel, but even here in chapter 1, Mark completely turns that entire system on its head. God comes, and God calls not the standard up-and-coming Pharisees or rabbis in training, but he calls a ragtag band of fishermen to be his inner circle. Chapter 1, verses 16 through 20. It's the people on the outside of society, people on the fringes, who are constantly getting his attention, his mercy, his healing. It's the leper, it's the demon-possessed. While the typical insiders, the religious elites, completely miss who he is. They don't get it. And maybe most shocking of all, when you read through Mark 1 and the other early chapters in Mark, maybe most shocking of all, Mark goes out of his way to present it as only demons know who Jesus is. You want to talk about flipping our insider track as much on its head as possible. Early on, for a long way throughout the book, only demons truly understand who Christ is, the Holy One of God. There is one we need to know, and Mark presents him. And the ones we naturally think we'll get to know, Mark completely reverses and turns it around. Peter Salovey is president of Yale right now. When I was a student, Peter Salovey was the dean. And at our incoming freshman address, Salovey told this story. Before he got into administration, he was a psychology professor. He was a terrific professor. He was well-loved. And Salovey remembered how his first semester as a professor at Yale, he was a little bit intimidated. And so he told himself going into that first class, don't let them push you around. These snotty little students, do not let them push you around. Don't be intimidated by how much money their family has given to the school or who their parents all are. Don't let them bully you. You show them who's boss. And he made it the whole way through the semester, all the way up to the final exam. And he gets to the final exam and he starts to spell out all the rules. And like all finals at Yale, the test was to be 3 hours long. 3 hours. Every single final we had was that long. And we had these blue books. They're about this big, little booklet, just lined. And other than the lines, they were blank pages, about 16 pages each. And for the entire way through that final, you just wrote and wrote and wrote. And it didn't matter if you were in an English class or an economics class or a math class, whatever the course, you had these blue books. And if you filled up one blue book, you could go forward and get another one and keep on going. And after the end of the 3 hours, we had a 30-minute editing period where you weren't supposed to write new material. The intent was for you to be able to go back and touch up, proofread what you had already written. And the whole way through that process, they would be giving you the countdown, just like you see in the movies. 1 hour left, half an hour left, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 seconds, pencils down. And when they said pencils down, ideally you had already walked forward and turned in your test. But if not, boy, when they said pencils down, you better put that thing down and stop trying to get extra points. Well, Salovey's first time administering a final, it's his first semester there, he does the whole countdown thing, he gets close to the end, and as he nears the end, he sees that one boy, one freshman, is frantically writing the whole way, even through the editing period, just writing, writing, writing. The other students start to finish. There were several hundred people in the class, and so people start walking forward, submitting their tests, and the stack of blue books begins to grow and grow and grow. And Salovey shouts out, 10 minutes, and the boy is still writing. 5 minutes, scribbling. And Salovey's just staring at him. What is he doing? I can't believe it. Can't believe his nerve. He's writing through the editing period. 1 minute, frantically still writing. 30 seconds. Everyone else is done, gone, starting to clear out. 15 seconds. 10 seconds. Pencils down. Keeps on writing. That's nerd for her. That's fighting words. Keeps on going. Salve's starting to get furious. Pencils down. Nothing. Time's up. And the boy continues to ignore him. He was not deaf, by the way. Okay, so that's what you're starting to wonder. Salovey walks up to the boy's desk. He's carrying this enormous stack of blue books. He walks up to his desk and says, "You must stop. You must be finished." And the boy looks up at him and says, "You don't know who I am, do you? You have no idea who I am." And Salovey says to himself, "Oh no, he doesn't. There is no, he thinks he's going to push me around. I do not care. I don't care who his dad is. I don't care what his legacy is, how much money they've given, famous they are. I don't care. You're going to scare the first year teacher? No, I don't care." And so Salovey says, "No, I don't know who you are." And he had every intention of getting out, and "I don't care." But before he could, all he says is, "No, I don't know who you are." And the young man says, "Good," and shoves his blue book into the mix of the stack and runs away full speed. Salovey was so impressed, so surprised, he didn't even bother to try to figure out, you know, which one it was stuck in at a certain angle. Right? Not at all what he was expecting. Insider track, sometimes being an outsider and unknown, sometimes being an outsider actually has the advantage. It's exactly what Mark is telling us, especially when it comes to knowing God. The whole way through the first chapter, it's the outsiders, not the insiders, who get close to Christ. So if being an insider is not what will get you to Him, what will? Number three. In chapter 1, verse 45, we read, Jesus could no longer enter a town freely, but had to stay outside in lonely places. Stay outside in lonely places. And while He was there on the outskirts, many came to Him, and He was found by them there at the outside. Frank Honeycutt, who I quoted last week with the line about getting off of the spiritual hamster wheel, Honeycutt also had a line in one of his sermons where he said, no matter where we draw the line in the Gospels, insider, outsider, respected, dejected, mainstream, marginalized, no matter where we draw the line in the Gospels, Jesus has a habit of appearing on the other side of the line. Insider and outsider, and Jesus continually goes to the outside and people find Him there. And you see, here it's due to His rising popularity. Right? He's so well loved, there's no room for Him. Here it's due to His popularity, but even this foreshadows a time when Jesus Christ would be thrust to the outer fringes, thrust to the margins in a vicious way, not a popular way. The popularity itself was based here on a misunderstanding of who He really was and not a true acceptance of Him. But He could only stay outside in lonely places, even here with the popularity, could only stay in lonely places, and people still came to Him from everywhere. It foreshadows the end of the book on both accounts. Christ would be thrust out. He goes to the cross, thrust from His Father's presence, cast outside the city, outside the community, alone with criminals, the loneliest of all places. He goes to the outside, and it is there, and it is only there, that He has been found by so many. It is there that people find Him and can come to Him. And it is only there, in the desolation, in the loneliness, that you can find Him, that you can know God. It's actually the whole way through the chapter. At the very beginning, He's baptized and He is sent out into the desert. His messenger was a radical on the fringe, one calling in the desert, chapter 1, verse 3. John was a social outsider. He had clothing made of camel's hair, and all he ate were locusts and wild honey, chapter 1, verse 5. Jesus called fishermen, as I mentioned. It was only demons who knew who He was, chapter 1, verse 24 and 134, not the people He came to save. He was a man of prayer, chapter 1, verse 35, and He gets up early in the morning to go off to lonely places, solitary places, to have that prayer. He heals the lepers, heals the sick, heals the demon-possessed, has compassion on the marginalized, the oppressed, and the outcast. And if you are going to follow Him too, if we are going to know Him too and be healed by Him, this is where you will find Him. This is where you will meet Him. Not in your strength, but in recognizing your need on the outside. No matter where we draw the line, Jesus has a habit of showing up on the other side. Outsider knowledge, not the inside. Outsider knowledge. Have to recognize our own outsider status to know Him, and it has to change our view of others we typically think are on the outside. It has to change how we approach as a church those who are not yet on the inside of our circle. We have an event coming up, February 9th. You've heard us talking about this for months. It's called A Night to Shine. It's a prom-style event for special needs individuals. It's through the Tim Tebow Foundation. We are partnering with King Street to put this on. King Street is hosting. We are helping to supply some of the workers. We've had a good response so far. We still need some help. We still need some help. And the area where we most need help are the buddies. Those who simply will be with, one-on-one, those who will be with a special need guest throughout the evening. To help them, to partner with them, to keep them company, to show them love and care. We want to show the promotional video for this one more time. And as we watch this, I want to encourage you to ask, am I willing to help those our society typically considers on the outside? You can see the list of needs, the insert in your bulletin. We need 16 buddies. There was also some need for some parking lot attendants and some other behind-the-scenes jobs. In communication with Kim and Tanya this week, helping to organize the event, I love their perspective. They said more than just trying to fill slots, we want to emphasize the heart behind, will we be the hands and feet of Jesus showing love to the marginalized? Will you be one to help us? Let's watch this video together, please. If you're anything like me, it's easy to watch things like that and think, I'll sign up later. Now is the later. We've been excited about this as a church. Now let's follow through and make it happen. We serve as a family. I'll mention volunteers do need to be 14 and older to help. But if that fits you, will you serve as a family? Maybe serve as a small group? If we want to know the living Christ, this is where we'll find Him. Lord Jesus, we give You praise that You have come to this earth. We confess joyfully You are the presence of God that we have so needed. I pray that You would continue to draw this church outside of ourselves. We give You great praise for the many ministries we have going on in-house. Would You ever expand our reach to those who are not yet in here, that we might show Your love as You did to those on the fringes? We pray that You would do this in us as we know You in the humility of knowing our own status before You, and as we are filled with Your Holy Spirit within us. In Your name I pray. Amen. To sign up, I should have mentioned this earlier. To sign up, simply just go to the website. All right, that's the most direct. Visit nighttoshine2018.com. If you want to sign up, nighttoshine2018.com. You know, we're getting in touch with the church office. Next week, we plan to talk more about knowing the living Christ, outsider knowledge. Let's go and find Him out there this week. Take care.